It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
There goes a fly ball towards left field. Going back fast is Kennedy. Kennedy gets there, and he takes it. And the Cleveland Indians are the world champions of 1948. And they are leaping joyously as they go off the field. Din is being mobbed as our Lou Boudreau head out in center field. Tucker and Kennedy come running in arm in arm.
This is Cleveland's Team, a baseball history podcast.
A regular look back at professional baseball in Cleveland from 1901 and beyond.
No score. Pitch to Robinson. Line drive to left field. We're back. It is gone. Mike Robinson gets it a home run in his first at bat as the playing manager of the Indians. How about that?
Now, here's your host, Guardians team historian, Jeremy Fedor.
Hello, Cleveland baseball fans. I am back with our history podcast, a bit under a new name. This podcast is now called Cleveland's Team, a baseball history podcast, and I'm really excited to get back in the swing of things. Last few months, I've been having a few conversations with some individuals, and now I'm able to finally get those into podcast form. So this first podcast we have here was actually an interview I recorded back in June with Brian Powers. And if you remember his name, he is the gentleman that recreated Cleveland's historic League Park. He's an architect and was able to use original blueprints and a computer system to, or a software system. I know what I'm talking about, to recreate what League Park actually looked like for a bulk of its history. So when I had the first interview with him in the first podcast, he was still in the process of creating League Park. But since I think it was March, he finished. And in June, we sat down and recorded another interview. So I am trying to, ascertain what he learned from his project, and it was a fascinating interview. And when we were talking, I led off with kind of a overarching big question of our loaded question of, you know, what were your biggest takeaways? Were there things that you learned that you didn't think you'd learn, or things that you never could figure out because the blueprints only tell you so much? And this was Brian's response.
Well, I'll take the first part of the question is really what have I learned? I think it's been, since October since we chatted last. And obviously, I finished the project right around March, early April. And that whole journey was actually quite rewarding. I think if there's any one thing I've learned was how important it is the ballpark was, and how much of an anchor it was to the Huff neighborhood there in Cleveland. I think as I got into more of the details since the last time we talked, one thing I really started to channel my focus in was the neighborhood around League Park as well. I started to develop the site a little bit, expand from the bounds around the ballpark. And from that point, I was able to kind of see on a decade-by-decade timeline the impacts that League Park had on the community. You know, you look at maps, you look at plans from when it was say remodeled, say 1910. You look at these street maps from 1920, 30, 40 up until the Indians left, how transformational that neighborhood was. I think it really peaked out, and you know, the height, you know, when the trolley car served it, Tricar served it, how much integrated it was with the community. I mean, within a one or two block area of the ballpark, I mean, you had residentials, you had school, recreation, all these amenities for the community, and the ballpark was the central anchor of that. And I think if there's any one thing I would say went off on a tangent on, but I looked at it as a sort of a new challenge, was start to understand the community more. I think it was a little bit different than the Comiskey Park project, where, you know, you weren't quite in the downtown area, but, you know, this really had a profound impact on it. And, you know, anytime I found that, you know, through the projects I've worked on, or any research project for that matter, it's real easy to kind of go down a rabbit hole, but sometimes that's the beauty of it. You know, it's the element of discovery, what you find along the way, that not only educates you maybe on this ballpark or this historical aspect, but the people around it and the neighborhood around it. League Park was certainly pretty amazing in that regard.
And Brian happened to be in town during the Power of Sports Summit that was held at the ballpark, and I was curious to know if he was able to actually get out to League Park. You know, you probably stare at it for long enough on the computer, you want to go see what's left of the real thing. And fortunately, he was able to get out to League Park.
Yes, I did. I had a chance to visit League Park when I was in town for the Power of Sports Summit during the NFL Draft Week. I did manage to carve some time out to visit 66 in Lexington, visited the museum, strolled around the park a little bit. I think of all sense of irony, you know, I was there on right at the same time they dedicated the inaugural pitch when the park was dedicated. You know, I think it was at that same day, same hour. I took a picture of it. I posted it. You know, it was like 110 years, 100, I take it back. From the park, when the park was dedicated back in the late 1890s to the day, I was there right at that same moment. So I kind of had the whole place to myself. It was kind of awesome, but I felt like there was a certain presence there. And, you know, when I had a chance to visit, it was great to really see that. And to kind of go back and reflect on it, you know, some of the details and some of the, you know, once you complete the project and kind of see it again in person, you know, there's certain elements that reveal themselves to you. And I was able to absorb myself in some of those details and kind of compare it to what my final product was.
And as Brian mentioned before, during his construction or reconstruction of League Park, one of the things he began to notice more and more was the kind of cityscape around the actual ballpark and how they kind of complemented each other. So when he had a chance to actually go see League Park again, I was curious if he was able to kind of walk around the outside and see what it looked like now. And, you know, it's drastically different than how it looked when that last game was played in the 40s. If you look over in the right field, there's no, you know, Andrews Moving Company building, or there was a school again behind the fence, and just the housing stock has changed a lot. And I think there's probably only a handful of houses that are original to when League Park was there on the four corner sort of perimeter. So that was my next question for him.
Yeah, I did. I thought that was one of the more rewarding experiences of my visits. I walked around the entire block area, which encompassed League Park. I went about maybe one or two blocks, you know, beyond that. And there were a few homes that I could probably date that were still around back when League Park was still in existence. I mean, granted, there wasn't many. You know, as I alluded to, the neighborhood is underwent, you know, such of a transformation, you know, in the last 50 years. You know, it was it declined, and now it's starting to come back. You know, there's a variety of different housing that's going up. And I think because people are starting to realize the legacy of League Park, and, you know, due to the commitment, you know, by the city of Cleveland, you know, where they really put some time into it, and we're starting to see some of the fruits of the labor of the community and the neighborhood start to come back. You know, it's not an overnight process, but yeah, even though there's a lot of empty lots and there's quite a variety of different scenarios, if you would, I was real encouraged to see that there are signs of development coming back, and I think it can only get better, and I'm looking forward to it.
And when you create a large history project, whether it's recreating a ballpark or doing a large-scale research project, there's always questions that just never get answered. And especially with something like League Park, there's only so many photographs. I'm sure the blueprints only tell you so much that there's questions that you, again, just can't answer. And I wanted to pose that question to Brian. And overall, it didn't seem like there was too much left unsaid about the ballpark. And again, this was his response.
I think for the most part, I was able to cover most of what I set out to do, but inevitably there's always those few little details. I think as you immerse yourself into the project, you think, well, gosh, if I could just go back in time and look around that corner and see what was there, how that worked out. That's always, you know, hindsight. But there are a couple things as I delved into the history of the park. The Indians really looked quite seriously to expand the ballpark, especially along the outfield. They wanted to add, there was talks about adding an upper deck. Osborne Engineering did a study of that. I really would like to see that. I think it's one series of documents I never really saw. I read about it here and there. There are a couple of newspaper articles, but you know, the Indians purchased this some property directly behind the center field fence with the intention of expanding the park. You know, this was I think around the mid to late 30s, and in that time, of course, Municipal Stadium was on the drawing boards, and by that time, they're committed to move down. Indians were committed to move downtown. You know, at that point in time, too, like many urban ballparks, the automobile really started to become quite prevalent, and it kind of phased out, the trolley system. People started to move out of the neighborhoods, things like that. But going back to your original question, I would say that's probably the biggest thing is really, I really wanted to get a grasp on what the long-term or what could have been the long-term, improvements for League Park. So that certainly was one of them, and I think anytime you do a lot of research, as you get into some of these other details, you always find conflicting information here and there. One thing was always what the official listed capacity was. In some circles, it was 21,414. But you always ask yourself, okay, does that include standing room, bleachers? How do they count that? Was there something I overlooked? So you always digging in a little bit deeper. There's always something I think you could find. I think in a way, infinitely, you can kind of go back and look at all these things. And of course, there's other challenges too. I think one kind of pleasant challenge I enjoyed it too was recreating all the period signage and graphics, things like that, like the Life Buoy soap, and just trying to find the vintage ads, that were replicas of what was built in the ballpark. A lot of times, because of the proportionality of the billboards, clubs had to design their own signage, and a lot of what you saw out there was not what you typically find in the back of your game program or on the newspapers, magazines, whatever. So you have to be very creative as to how you recreated those signs, much like I did with my model. The park was faced with the same issue.
And we'll be back after a quick break. And we're back. Now, one of the fun things I think of speaking to someone that's an architect that can read blueprints, they're going to be able to figure out things that, someone like me who's got a background in history and has enough time or hard enough time looking at IKEA directions, they're able to see something that's there that I wouldn't see that can maybe help, again, tell the story of League Park. So with the questions that went unanswered, I was very curious as to what questions or what interesting things did Brian figure out. Previous podcast, we had spoke about, one of the bathrooms had a window you could still see the field, and just one of those things that never would have been captured, in photographs or in newspapers. And, Brian had some interesting thoughts on that.
I would say probably some of the more interesting things I found out, League Park was very well thought out, in terms of spectator flow, seat structure and usage. If you had a type of ticket, whether it was a section or a different color or whatever, you had a very definitive path, you know, into the stadium and a very clear direction as to where you were seating. You know, most ballparks, you kind of walk in, it's very open, you can kind of meander around. But come to find out, what I thought was fascinating, League Park was very kind of like a herding cattle, you know, in a way. You come in through the ticket office, you know, with your ball, with your ticket, whether it's in the box seats or the pavilions. You make your way through a series of fences and gates, you know, to your seat. Even the upper deck boxes they had up there, they even had their own special cross aisles and stairs, you know, as you get up there. So it was very methodical in terms of how they corralled the people. And the same thing when they exited the ballpark. And I come to find out, you know, through my interpretation of the blueprints, some of the drawings I had were a little bit different than maybe what was on file, you know, with the city or what I've seen on like auction blocks, you know, things like that. I found a comment from the city of Cleveland when they reviewed it back in 1909 for permit approval. They felt it didn't have enough exits. So they asked the Indians or Osborne to add another exit in the wall. In fact, it's that very small arch exit that still exists today. You know, if you go along 66, you know, with the existing wall, that small archway was added well after a fact. It didn't originally appear in all the drawings. So there's other little quirks like that, I think, that reveal themselves, you know, as I kind of guide into to things further. And then a lot of other details, you know, like the passive air system, you know, that cooled the fans off, you know, with the shutters and the louvers and the ability to use natural light to illuminate the concourse, you know, as people walked around the ballpark, I thought was very fascinating.
One of the things that I often wonder is, you know, how League Park could have adapted to still be in use today. Obviously, there are examples with Wrigley and Fenway, but the cards, you know, just didn't play out for League Park, and you know, the club moved to Municipal Stadium. But I wanted to ask Brian too. Was it the fact that it was such a neighborhood ballpark that with the advent of more car ownership, you know, there was nowhere to park? So how would you accommodate large crowds trying to get to the ballpark with no parking and you know, cars everywhere? And again, Brian had this response.
Yes. I mean, so much League Park was such a classic example of a neighborhood ballpark, and it was very dependent on the public transportation system and, you know, the trolley system that served it. I think once people got more dependent on the automobile, it really started to impact the way people attended games. You know, people wanted convenience, and it changed the way people lived, really. You know, moved people out to the suburbs. Automobiles became more affordable. People started to move away from the city core. I think in some respects, that was kind of the beginning of the end. Not the end, but beginning of the initial decline of the Huff neighborhood. And then you started to see the transformation in the, you know, the makeup of the neighborhood, people that were coming in. You know, you had the riots and everything back in the mid 20th century, 60s, I think it was. And things were pretty tense there for a while. And, you know, and I think a lot of people just look for ways to get rid of or to get away from that. But I think to address the question is, yeah, I think a lot of urban ballparks, the ones that survive to this day, you look at Wrigley and you look at Fenway Park, they have a very, very strong public transportation system, and they've been able to adapt well, you know, even coexisting, you know, with the automobile to a certain degree. You know, you got certain mixed uses that infuse the neighborhood. Like I said at the early part of this talk here, League Park had residential, they had stores, they had factories, schools, all within a two-block area of the ballpark, and that really sustained the community. And League Park was just one of those things in it. And I think if League Park were around that same site in the 20th century hosting Major League Baseball, yeah, it would have to be somewhat similar, like maybe what you'd see in Wrigleyville, you know, in Chicago. And certainly could have, you know, everything's hindsight, but you know, it would have made it for a very vibrant neighborhood. You know, some things would have gone one way or the other.
I mentioned it in the first podcast with Brian that Leek Park wasn't his first foray into creating or recreating ballparks. He actually did Chicago's Comiskey Park. So I wanted to know, now that he was done with both of them, if he was able to find similarities or a lot of differences between the two ballparks.
Yeah, there were some similarities. One thing I thought was fascinating, I was able to overlay cross sections of Leek Park over Comiskey Park. And you know, when you look at a stadium in section, that really tells the story right there. And I thought what was fascinating about Leek Park was, in my opinion, it has one of the more, or had one of the most intimate upper decks, you know, in baseball. I mean, the upper deck was literally right above the lower deck, and you were within, you know, 65 feet of the field at any given point, you know, in the, you know, from that area, you know, looking down onto the field. So I think when you look at it in section, you saw how intimate Leek Park was, how close to the action you were. Comiskey was somewhat similar to that. The difference between Comiskey and Leek Park, most of the seats in Comiskey Park were concentrated on the lower deck and the pavilions. And as a result of that, your lower bowl was much deeper. And if you're sitting towards the back of the slower bowl, you're a lot farther away from the action. So Leek Park being confined, you know, to that neighborhood block, the seats went right up against the street. You know, if you look at it in section, you know, the top row of the lower deck, as well as the upper deck, is almost right up against the, you know, property line of the city block. So that really kind of dictated how the geometry in the ballpark was laid out. And because of that intimacy, you know, Leek Park was a wonderful place to watch a game. You know, there's always debate in terms of you know, how columns, you know, might infringe, you know, on your sight lines. But sometimes, you know, there might be a small sacrifice, you know, to be able to get a lot more people close to the action. So you're always trying to find where that sweet spot was. And Comiskey and Leek Park approached those things somewhat differently, but the result was the same. I concur that both those places were great places to watch baseball.
Getting into more of the minute details, when you think of these older ballparks, you often think of obstructed views with beams and pillars being in the way. So I was curious as to how much that was an issue with Leek Park.
There were, yeah, it was probably comparable to a lot of ballparks. I think Leek Park, since the lower deck was quite small, you didn't have quite as many rows behind the columns like you do, like maybe you did at Comiskey Park. So as a result of that, a good portion or a good percentage of the seats in Leek Park had unobstructed views to the field.
And we'll be back after another quick break. And we're back. Now that Brian is done with the project, I was curious, what was the end goal? Where does this live? And what do you hope to get out of it?
Actually, we formed a partnership with the Baseball Heritage Museum right there in Cleveland. We're working to make the Leek Park project a permanent display at the museum. So, yeah, the wheels are in motion to get what I've done this last year display so the public can see it. I'll always have it available on my website to visit, www.bandboxballparks.com. But we're looking for new and innovative ways to engage the people in the community as to what was there before. The museum is a wonderful place to get a feel for what's left of the park. But one thing I found out in my visit to Cleveland is both residents and even visitors didn't realize, you know, the park existed there like it did. You know, we're talking, you know, 70 years since it was knocked down. Not many people, with the exception maybe of a few pictures, really understood what the structure was like when it's there. So with this partnership with the museum, it'll be a permanent display, and I'm exploring mechanisms through augmented and virtual reality to be able to increase the interactivity, you know, with my exhibit. So hopefully, you know, it'd be nice to maybe hold up a tablet, walk around the site, and see the ballpark right in front of you.
And now that League Park is done, if you follow Brian at his Twitter handle at SportsBandbox, you'll know that he is, getting closer to being done with the Reds' old field, Crosley Field. So that was his, or is his next project. And I was kind of curious why he was staying in Ohio and looking at that ballpark.
Well, staying in state, but going to the National League this time. I'll be working on Crosley Field in Cincinnati, Ohio. It was home of the Reds from 1912 through 1970. Of course, they played baseball in that very same site, you know, many years before. But being the oldest baseball franchise in baseball, there's certainly a lot of history and legacy that can be shared. I've always thought, I've always had another fascination for Crosley. There's a lot of little quirks on it, you know, that weren't as prevalent maybe in other ballparks. Most people think of the rising outfield terraces, which are quite unique, but it's also built as part of that, you know, within that same building boom, you know, that Comiskey Park, League Park, Fenway Park was opened that same year, Wrigley a couple years later. So it would really be neat to, as this develops, you know, really, really start to compare all these ballparks together and just really see what it's like to experience it. Crosley Field, I think in many respects, it's another classic urban ballpark. You know, if you see a lot of pictures before they put the interstate in there, it's a very high density neighborhood, you know, much like the Huff neighborhood was, you know, in Cleveland. So I think given some of the tangents I experienced, you know, looking into the neighborhoods of League Park, I'll be able to draw upon that and kind of compare it to see how the ballpark physically impacted the surrounding neighborhood, you know, there in Cincinnati.
And not only was Brian switching from the American League to the National League, but he was also researching a non-Osborne Engineering ballpark as well.
No, actually, Crosley Field was designed by a Cincinnati architect named Harry Hake Jr. He actually designed part of the Palace of the Fans, and he had a strong relationship with the Crosleys. So he was responsible for the initial ballpark when it was rebuilt in 1912, on various renovations, you know, that happened throughout it. But I think Crosley was his only ballpark, but he certainly put a lot of time and effort into it over the years. And I think it'll be interesting to kind of see how some of his details differentiated themselves from an Osborne park, which were the last two I've done.
And me being the history archive, person that I am, I was really interested then because Brian said, not Osborne. It was just this other guy that his only ballpark he helped create. Was it going to be difficult to reconstruct Crosley because, Osborne's still in existence. They probably still have the blueprints, but this was a little bit different.
And that was actually one of the reasons why I chose Crosley Field. As I was investigating to determine what my next project will be, just out of a whim, I think it was late January, early February, I sent a note to Cincinnati Historical Museum library there, and archives, to see if they had anything on Crosley Field and Harry Hake. I did read that they housed a lot of his archives, that was on file with his office as well as the city. So I reached out and just see if they happen to have anything on his ballpark. And say about 3 or 4 weeks later, they got back with me and said, they're able to dig in one of the vaults. And they came across the original documents for Crosley Field. So that was a game changer right there. I thought, yes, I think that's one of my requirements. If I have the proper documentation to tell the story, I'll definitely do it. So I was very fortunate. I spent about 3 days in Cincinnati, going over those documents. I even visited the replica of Crosley in Blue Ash, just outside of town. It's actually a field in a replica of the original scoreboard. So what I try to do is just immerse myself into the neighborhood and just the people around it to get the feel for the people and the ballpark.
I wanted to leave it open a little bit to Brian if he had any, you know, final thoughts on League Park. And again, here's what he said.
That's pretty much the good gist of it. You know, like yourself, I could really go into and talk about the details of the park, just a lot of unique features. But I tried to capture everything I did through my Twitter account and kind of archived it, as well as created interactive exhibits on my website. So if you were to visit my website, you could tour both the clubhouses, home and visitors. You know, I have different videos so you can walk around the concourses, fly around the park, walk through the ticket office, up the ramp, find your seat. So I'm hopeful I was able to capture the spirit of the park and open the doors to Indians fans, see what it was like to see a game there back in the day.
And as Brian and I continued to talk after I thought we were done with the interview, he offered this really interesting and neat story, I think, in terms of creating the park and some of the smaller details that, you know, he had to figure out.
A good example, I think, is, you know, working with my followers, I had an example where we had kind of some unsolved mysteries, you know, in the park. You're asking me a little bit earlier about some of the challenges. You know, the left field bleachers, I had some signage at the very top of it that ran across the top, and very few clear photos existed what that actually said. And I was able to decipher through various sources, you know, the first part of it. It's actually, come to find out, a public service announcement. It actually said, Cleveland values your life, protect it, drive carefully, walk sensibly. You know, it was classic public service announcement. I thought it said, instead of walk sensibly, wear seat belts, you know, the blurred photographs. And then through the help of numerous followers, we were able to piece together what it actually said. One gentleman, you know, found a photo inside Old Municipal Stadium that had that same public service announcement. So I was able to solve the mystery, correct my model, and get it accurate. So that's what makes it fun.
And that concludes our episode of Cleveland's Team, a baseball history podcast. Thanks for checking this out. Also, thank you to Brian Powers for chatting with me again about his League Park project. If you are interested, the Baseball Heritage Museum at League Park does have the complete project up and available to fans coming through the ball or through the museum. You can check it out while you're at League Park. So again, I think that's a really neat way to see what the ballpark looked like and then be able to go out the doors and kind of walk around and have your bearings set. But again, thank you for joining us, and looking forward to doing more of these.
You've been listening to Cleveland's Team, a baseball history podcast with Guardians team historian Jeremy Fedor.